Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientist, 15th of September 2018. As people will know, it's cardiac rehab or cognitive rehab, as I learn to read with interest for perhaps a bit over an hour as I read through this. So this is the editorial article, with no, I suppose the editor would have to be Emily Wilson, and the topic is Smashing Achievement, and you see inside the Large Hadron Collider, a colossal piece of engineering. Just even to watch it now, it's just incredible to think of it. Okay. The Large Hadron Collider is a decade old and it's not done yet. Next July will mark 50 years since humans set foot on the moon. The rumblings of commemoration can already be heard. Even now, Ryan Gosling, deputizing for Neil Armstrong in the film First Man, is being castigated for failing to plant an American flag in the lunar regolith. The moon landing was the first truly global media event, an iconic expression of human desire to explore and explain the universe. It's odd, then, that the anniversary of an event embodying the same aspiration has passed on the 10th of September with so little fanfare. With a global audience of more than 1 billion, the switch on the Large Hadron Collider was actually seen by more people than the moon landing. As we said at the time, it was, quote, to the physics that the Apollo program was to space exploration. No doubt, the resistance is in part due to the numerous failure of the gleaming new particle accelerator just 10 days after start-up. But in truth, the euphoria of the early days has given way to a more sober reality. Let's celebrate the positives. For a start, the LHC did not destroy the world by sucking it into a black hole, as doom-mongers predicted at the time. Fake news. I sort of think it's necessarily fake news. It's fake news is where you have a news source and you can't tell whether it's true or not. Then there's the Higgs boson, of course. Its discovery, the LHC, in 2012, represents the crowning glory of a standard model of particle physics, our best step so far at ordering the bric-a-brac of reality. Isn't that beautifully put? This was the final confirmation of the theoretical idea conceived 5 years before Armstrong took his one small step, an aspiring validation of a purely intellectually human endeavour. It is also where our problem starts. Quote, there's an enormous elephant in the room. Normally they are enormouses, aren't they? And that's, we know how the standard model is not the final, the standard model is not the final theory, says Tara Shields of the University of Liverpool and the LHCb experiment. It fails to explain the nature of phenomena such as dark matter, dark energy, or even why the measured Higgs mass teeters on the very lowest boundary of what's possible in a stable universe. Supersymmetry was a much vaunted successor to the standard model, predicting a swarm of additional particles to shore it up. Quote, the LHC has meticulously searched the open as well in various nooks and crannies for these and has shown that they are not there, says Ben Alnitch of the University of Cambridge, a former supersymmetry adherent. That's a blow to theorists' egos. Conditioned by string success accumulating the Higgs discovery, it suggested that whatever better theory is out there, it will still have the beauty of supersymmetry. But no one said that probing the essence of reality was easy. The LHS has already determined the contents of the universe with greater precision than any machine before. Planned upgrades and new analysis techniques will further sharpen its eye. Hints of anomalies already seen may yet lead to insights. If things have gone quiet around LHC, it's silence of committed, concentrated endeavour. In Shear's words, quote, we have to wait, work hard and see. Hang on in there. Happy birthday, LHC. it's a large collider in CERN. It's 23 kilometer radius, I think. I suppose it's radius, and it's beneath the Swiss and French borders underground. Underground stops muons from the upper atmosphere interfering and hurting the instruments. So it's pretty amazing to know that we're in an accelerator. The cosmic rays slam against our upper atmosphere, and thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of muons, which are heavy electrons, shower through us all the time. So that's what's under the ground. That's what I'm doing. And so it has two beams of proton and antiproton. So the proton gets accelerated. The antiproton, which is the same mass, opposite charge, gets, using exactly the same electronics, gets charged, accelerated the opposite way. It's slightly different radius, so they whip past each other except in the collision zone, where they have a probability of smashing each other. A lot of them have glancing blows, but every once in a while they hit straight on, proton versus proton, and actually hits in the center. The way things accelerates is that in front of it is seen, if you're a proton, you're positive, in front of it is seen a positive electrode, and behind it, sorry, a negative electrode, and behind it a positive electrode, which means this electric field pushing it forward. And since it passes that, that positive electrode, negative electrode, which is in front of it, turns to positive, and the next electrode along after it turns negative. So this, you have a travelling wave electric field which travels with the particle, always accelerating it. And so eventually the particles just gain mass and increase up to the really close to the speed of light, just gaining more and more energy as you go around. Of course, to a particle would be straight, so they have superconducting magnets to bend the field. Now, it's, if they bent it really tight, they'd make it all radiate. So ideally, you have a long accelerator, a linear accelerator, has no problems of breaking or bending radiation. So as you change the direction of an accelerated particle, or a linear particle, it will radiate out energy. So by having the such a large radius, you can mean that you can dump more energy in and take and get to a higher energy. So ultimately you need a bigger radius to get a larger energy threshold. Pretty amazing story. So these two come around and they smash to each other, and so what happens is that you get the energy of a proton and an antiproton, and you add on to that the mass of acceleration. You can just, you make a proton and you actually make something much, much heavier. So when it smashes together, it's got a zero net momentum. So the force one direction equals the force other ways, and you just get a spill of particles which convert to energy back into matter, and eventually back into energy. Everything eventually decays. You don't produce any new particles. Now, the next article here we have is called Bracing for Florence. And it shows a picture from, it looks like the space station, with underneath it this large, cyclone, or they call it a hurricane, I suppose. And in the center is a, the cyclone's in the southern hemisphere. Center is the eye. This is the statement about it. More than a million residents along the Atlantic coast of the US were ordered to evacuate last week as Hurricane Florence neared the coastline of North and South Carolina, Virginia, and Maryland. Governors in all four states declared an emergency ahead of what has been predicted as the worst deluge to hit the Carolinas in 30 years and the fiercest storm to hit the US this year. The governor of South Carolina gave residents the state's entire coastline an evacuation deadline of noon on Tuesday. When New Scientist went to press, the hurricane was expected to make landfall on Thursday around Wilmington, North Carolina, near the state's borders with South Carolina. The U.S. National Hurricane Center issues warning storm surges and flooding 220 kilometres per hour winds and large swells and rip currents affecting Bermuda and portions of the US East Coast. On Tuesday, Florence was nearing the highest hurricane rating, Category 5. At this level, it would bring winds about 251 kilometres per hour. Quote, life-threatening freshwater flooding is likely to be prolonged and exceptionally heavy rainfall event, which may extend inland over the Carolinas and the Mid-Atlantic for hundreds of miles as Florence is expected to slow down as it approaches the coast and move inland, said the National Hurricane Center bulletin on Monday. The center so warned that the damaging winds could spread well inland into part of the Carolinas and Virginia. So we have to explain that the energy of the cyclone comes from the latent energy stored in the water. So hot water cools by evaporation. That evaporative water gets pulled and sucked into the upper atmosphere. This goes to the upper atmosphere. Water is lighter than air. It's got a molecular mass of 18 versus air, which is 28 or 32 for nitrogen and oxygen. So it's 28, 32, 4. Let's just try and do this in your head. I'm just going to have a stab at it. In terms of what's the 28, 32, 4. So that's 4 to 1. It will be around 28.8, the average molecular mass of air. Water is much lighter than that, so that gets floated up in the air. When it goes up in the air to the condensation area, it creates an updraft wind, and so this wind is eventually pulled around by the Coriolis force into a spiral. So the faster the wind blows, the faster it takes off the latent heat of the ocean. So you need ocean temperature of a particular temperature, I think 23.5 degrees Celsius. Above this critical temperature, the wind is sufficient to just milk the solar energy stored in the water. So this water will power the storm. So this is why the storm suddenly begins. Okay, English health body in alcohol role. Two advisors to the Public Health England, PHE, have said they may quit their roles at the agency after it launched an alcohol awareness campaign in partnership with the organisation that receives funding from the drinks industry. The campaign launched this week by PHE, an alcohol education charity, Drink Aware, encourages middle-aged people to have at least 2 alcohol-free days a week. Drink Aware is largely funded by donations from the UK alcohol producers, retailers and supermarkets. The movie prompted Gilmore and John Britton, who are co-chair of the PHE advisory boards, to say that health officials had failed to learn the lessons from the way tobacco and alcohol industries use partnerships with health bodies to undermine or neutralise policies intended to reduce corruption. However, Lee Lewis, chair of Drink Aware, stressed the organisation's independence as a charity. Alright, thank you for doing it, but really, you shouldn't drink at all. Climate talks hit sticking points. Little progress was made in the latest round of climate talks in Bangkok last week. We didn't even know them here in Australia, where officials debate the rules that will govern the 2015 Paris Climate Change Agreement. Almost every country has now signed the agreement and so are committed to cutting their greenhouse emissions. This includes the US, despite a stated intention to withdraw from Bangkok. I understand California is doing well. They don't cover California there. They do, have they? No, I don't know. In Bangkok, the officials are trying to narrow down how countries could go about meeting their obligations. But there's numerous sticking points, such as China wanting different rules for developed and developing countries, and rich countries failing to provide the funds they promised to help the other countries. Small islands have contributed an almost immeasurably small fraction to the global emission, yet face the devastating climate impacts, said Amjad Abdullah from the Alliance of Small Island States. Quote, climate finance is not a handout, it's a logical and fair response to this history. But where there's progress is the next thing coming. While headway was slow in the latest UN climate talks he left. Elsewhere, there's been much skewed north out during California. And these are good news on the climate front. California is planning to go carbon neutral by 2045 and achieve a net negative emissions after that. Also, investors across the globe responsible for the $6 trillion funds now plan to divest from fossil fuels. On the 10th of September, the governor of California signed an executive order calling for statewide carbon neutrality by no later than 2045. That exceeds by far any other targets that countries signed up in the Paris Climate Agreement. A few countries and states have set themselves similarly ambitious goals, but California is now the biggest economy to do so. Meanwhile, the divestment movement continues to gather pace. According to a report, Arabella Advisor, more than 1,000 institutional investors with $6 trillion in assets have committed to divest from fossil fuels compared to just $52 billion 4 years ago. I don't quite understand that. Okay, by Claire Wilson, the oldest human drawing. This doesn't look much from here. Archaeologists say they have found a 73,000-year-old drawing, Claire Wilson. It's interesting that we're now finding art is not just the preserve of Homo sapiens. I think there's some art with Neanderthals. But just let's read what they have to say. From a cursory glance, the slides of a small brown stone could be mistaken for natural formation. In fact, the first known drawings ever made by human hands. It is, in fact, quote, "This is the beginning of a cultural modernity and sophisticated behaviour," says Colin Ridderfield, the University of Cambridge, who was not involved in the discovery. Okay. Quote, "You would be astonished if you found another animal species producing something like that. It's the origins of humankind." The laboratory analysis shows the dark red lines forming a rough crosshatch pattern must have been drawn with a chunk of soft-coloured stone called ochre, possibly the one whittled into a simple crayon. Attempts to create the pattern using the same materials show that the lines were no careless scrawls, but took deliberate effort. Quote, "You have to use a lot of pressure and control, or it doesn't leave enough ochre," said Christopher Hellishwood of the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, South Africa. Henschelwood and his colleagues dug up a drawing of a South African cave from the layers of earth dated about 73,000 years ago. So they're Homo sapiens, weren't they? This makes it nearly twice as old as its previously found Stone Age drawings or paintings by our own species. I think that would mean the Aboriginal line drawings. Oh no, listen. By our own species, although it was recently discovered that Neanderthals were painting caves in 64,000 years ago. Body humans, or Homo sapiens, evolved in East Africa about 200,000 years ago before the spreading north and south of the continent. The Blombos Cave in the south coast has been excavated for more than two decades, turning up a wealth of material from people living there as far back as 100,000 years ago. The artifacts uncovered include shell beads, sincere ticks made of stone and bone. Another provocative find was a painting kit. The paint, and made from ochre, charcoal, seal fat, was mixed with large snail shells, but so far no paintings have turned up. The newly found drawing is a rock just 4 by 1.5 centimetres was unearthed in 2011. But covered with dirt, drew no notice and was labelled and stored. Only when the muck was washed off in a search for a stone tools years later, did the team remember notice the markings, triggering a microscopic and chemical analysis of the ochre traces. Ochre comes from various forms and hues. This speaking type would have been about as hard as a child's colouring pencil, perfect for the job. This is Henschelwood. Going by the width of the lines, the tip was a 2 millimeter point that may have been deliberately sharpened. The lines extend right to the edges of the rock, suggesting that they were once part of a large artwork, later broken up. Most lines, the teams could tell the direction of the stroke, because microscopic bumps on the stone surface accumulated ochre on the opposite side of the crayon's approach. Well, there you go. Isn't that amazing? So you're not going to get, if it bumps up, you're going to get rubbed off, but not, like a wind shadow, rain shadow. The scribbler must have gone over the lines several times in a to and fro motion, making it thicker than the rest. There's no doubt that it was done deliberately, says Henschelwood. The stone canvas has told the story. Now what did something Voltaire said, canvas. Something about canvas. The cut. Embroider. Religion and... Something about... I just have to really remember what Voltaire said. The drawn-on surface is much smoother than the other sides, and the pits contain tiny traces of different kinds of ochre, that is, as hard as rock. This indicates it might have been initially been used as a grindstone for rubbing the hard ochre into powder, perhaps used for paint. Ethelwood says we don't know if the original crosshatch drawing was a decoration or had some symbolic meaning. Quote, if you have a little ochre pencil, perhaps for the first time you're able to store information outside your brain, so you can carry it across the landscape and leave a message anywhere. This shows that the minds of these people would have been very similar to ours today, says Clive Philson of the Gibraltar Museum. Quote, we're able to try to represent something by abstracting something. That suggests cognitive capabilities similar to ours. Impressive though it is, the drawing isn't the earliest ever artwork of our species. Okay. There are plentiful examples of early designs, including similar crosshatchings made by etching a simpler technique than drawing a crown. The first known etched design was found on a clamshell from Indonesia dated 500,000 years ago, so it must have been by a different species. Yeah, well, that's it. Okay. So this art is not human. That's, so 500,000 years ago, there you go, that beats the whole lot. Why leave that to the very end? So, it's not the earliest artwork. So the earliest artwork is before us. Isn't that amazing? I didn't know that. News and Technology by Leah Crane. Antimatter seen in two places at once. Sounds like quantum mechanics and a bit of Feynman diagrams. A particle can be in two places at once, even if it's made of antimatter. The result comes from antimatter twists and the classic experiments show the tenet of central quantum mechanics, that all particles are waves. Oh, God. Did I say that? In the basic double slit experiment, a beam of light illuminates a plate with two parallel slits in it, creating stripes of light on the screen behind it. Think of light as a single particle, as Isaac Newton argued, crepuscular, which is slightly different. You'd expect just two bright lines corresponding to two slits. Instead, you get an interference pattern as many stripes. This can be explained either as individual particles being at two places at once, and interfering themselves, or light behaving as a wave. So we actually say it's light behaving as a wave. You Copenhagen school people are just complete idiots. Variations of experiments have been repeated with many types of particles, showing that they're all waves as well. However, until now, it's never been known with a beam of antimatter. Antimatter is precious. It's hard to produce, and it's even harder to produce in a setup where you can make a beam out of it, says Michael Peskin, the Slack Accelerator, California, who was not involved in the work. Now, Akhtidar Agra of the University of Bern, Switzerland, has been to perform a double-slit experiment with positrons, antimatter equivalent of electrons. So that's not so much thing. The set starts off with radioactive sodium that sheds about 5,000 positrons per second. The positrons pass through a pair of circular openings, which focuses them into a beam. This is then aimed at two silicon nitride crystals, each of which acts as a set of many slits. Positrons that pass through the crystal and hits the screen that records when each one lands. Only about 100 positrons per second hit the screen, so the experiment ran for 200 hours to build up a strong image revealing stripes of light and dark showing the positrons' waves do interfere. This isn't the first time that antimatter particles have been shown to behave like waves, says Peskin. God, well, you know, if you can make an antimatter hydrogen atom, That surely is a way of description. Okay. But it's satisfying to achieve a classic double sit. It's a big technical challenge. This experiment was the first step of the researchers going to efforts to study the effect of gravity on antimatter, such as whether it floats upwards. Now that's an interesting thing, because you could do a gravity gradiometer with it. It'd be interesting if the things work differently. So that's the best way to do it. It's possible that gravity doesn't work exactly the same way for antiparticles and particles, and this could be part of the reason the universe doesn't appear to be made of the same amount of particles and antiparticles, it says David Christian of Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory in Illinois. I don't think that's their main concern. Okay. If gravity does act differently on matter and antimatter, it's only very slight distinction, so experiments will need to be extremely precise to reveal it. Quote, the effect of gravity on an individual particle is really tiny, even if it's the gravity of the whole Earth, says Christian. So I want gravity gradiometers, mate. How fossils spread after a mass shooting. Something that America has to worry about a lot. When a gunman who attacked students at the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, this February stopped shooting, 17 people were left dead or fatally injured. All of this, shortly after the tragedy, Twitter bots began sending out emotionally charged quips and conspiracy theories about what took place. However, a retrospective analysis of those tweets suggested that humans were the ones who spread them furthest. A team of University of South Carolina downloaded 7 million tweets posted during the one-month period shortly after the shooting, and those and isolated those originally posted by 400 bot accounts. Only automated accounts that appeared to be trying to influence people's opinions were included, rather than, for example, benign bot accounts used by news organizations to publish links to stories. The malicious bots sometimes appeared to simply make up provocative statements or source their contents from untrustworthy or politically extreme websites. But it was human responses to this content that really got the snowball rolling. Over 90% of the retweets were human-run accounts. One-third of the tweets shared in this way could be described to attempt to bait the users by targeting their beliefs, says Vanessa Kitch, who worked in the project. For example, one popular tweet referred to gun control dolts. Another described CNN as a Marxist. It's not clear who's behind the bots, tweeting, says about Parkland. Automated accounts succeed when they trick the humans and social media websites' algorithms, which select popular content and get them to share the message far and wide, says Mensa of the University of Indiana. I'm really struggling to really understand the relevance of that entire article. Oh, God. Control, a real space robot with virtual reality. A Japanese airline wants to send you to space. Well, not you exactly, but a robot avatar that you can control in real time, while seeing through its eyes and feeling what it feels in virtual reality. Sounds a lot simpler, mate. Absolutely. All Nippon Airways and Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency have just announced an Avatar X program to build humanoid drones and send them into space. The giant leap will be bringing humanoid consciousness and presence to remote locations, says Program Director, Co-Director Kevin Kajanti. I just think this is madness. As well as allowing people to experience space through the avatar, the robots could be used for farming and construction, and generally helping out astronauts, he says. Oh dear. The partners hope to begin building and testing avatars on Earth in 2019, moving to low Earth orbit for trials in the early 2020s, and then sending the bots to Moon or Mars. Robots could help out on the International Space Station, says Franz Zhu of the Cornell University in New York. Quote, say we've got a robot on the ISS and the human is on Earth with a virtual reality set, she says. The robot on IAS doesn't need life support. It won't be able to have health problems. It's not creating any waste, and you're limiting the risk to human life. Oh, I just find this painful to read. But it would be more efficient to have a single person in charge of several more autonomous robots, says Chris Anderson of Carnegie Mellon University. Well, my thoughts exactly. This really hurts me to think how stupid do you think people are? As for letting the general public experience space, the Avatar encounter might be less attention grabbing than hoped, he says. Quote, you have to give them something to do to keep them occupied for more than 15 minutes. Sanson, if you want to save a lot of money, just make a video game, fake it, and you can make something much more entertaining. My thoughts exactly, blood oath. Victoria Volcano could have helped doom hobbits by Michael Marshall. Now that sounds really interesting. About 50,000 years ago, on the Indonesian island of Flores, nearly all the large animals disappeared at once. The losses included dwarf elephants, carnivorous birds, a species of diminutive hominid called the hobbit. It's not clear why a volcanic eruption might have been the trigger, but there's also a tentative evidence that a new threat had reached the island, Homo sapiens. Okay. Poor little island. The hobbit was first described in 2004 after bones were found in Lungbowl Caves of Flores. And I actually know people who know these people, and these people were just smashed. Poor little people. So these are scientists. It stood about 1 meter tall and had a brain the size of a grapefruit. And in 2016, the researchers led by Thomas Sukan, the University of Wollongong, concluded the species probably vanished from Flores 50,000 years ago. Now, since and his colleagues have dated 300,000 animal fossils and 10,000 stone tool fragments from Lingbao, revealing the local ecosystems changed significantly at this time. Before this cutoff, the Lingbao area was dominated by elephants the size of large cows. There was also two bigger scavenger birds, a large vulture, and a giant marabou stork, stood about 1.8 metres tall. Finally, the area was the home of the Komodo dragons, the world's largest lizard. All four species last appeared at Lingbao 50,000 years ago. The next settlements were laid down 46,000 years ago, quote, we no longer see these large animals, says the researcher team manager Matthew Locker of Lakehead University of Canada. Komodo dragons clung on elsewhere on Flores. Today they live on the island's north coast, but other three species are now extinct. The loss of elephants may have triggered an ecological collapse. Quote, once they go, clearly the marabou stork and vulture disappear right away, because there's nothing large enough for them to survive on, says Tokyo Komodo dragons may have survived on the coast because they eat marine carrion, they said. With the elephants gone, the hobbits lost the major food source too. So what killed the elephants? Settlements revealed that there was a big volcanic eruption in 50,000 years ago, which could have disrupted the ecosystem, says Hannah Regan of the University of Nottingham, UK. It is possible then that the hobbits were driven extinct as a consequence of volcanic eruption. But there's another possibility. Before 50,000 years ago, the tools at Lingbao were mostly made from volcanic rock called sulfide tuft, probably by hobbits. After this time, the tools were mostly made by chert, a material favoured by Homo sapiens. Well, I've got to remember what tuft and chert is. Okay. This may be evidence that our species had arrived for us. They could have hunted the elephants to extinction, says stories, which might have left the hobbits unable to cope. So it's interesting that the tools, there's a big tool change with the animals going out, indicating that humans were there. That's really interesting. Okay, one of my favourite scientists, Schrodinger. Poor Schrodinger. What has he got to say? Okay. Field notes. Schrodinger at 75, Dublin, Ireland. That's 75 years, Sasha? I don't know. Biology's greatest hits pulls a crowd. Quote, I'm a neuroscientist, it's by Graham Lawton. Quote, I'm a neuroscientist, and we have a technical expression in the field, group psychologist researcher Christopher Koch, my brain is full. I know how he feels. After 24 talks, delving deep into some of the most exciting ideas in science, minds fit to burst. Little man. Over the past 2 days, I've met 6 Nobel Prize winners, plus some good bets of future invitees to Stockholm. All were here in Dublin to celebrate the 75th anniversary, of his famous Ruby Life speech, I suppose. Let's read. Of Dublin's to celebrate the 75th anniversary of the most famous lectures in science. In 1943, Austrian physicist Aaron Schrödinger stood in the Physics Lecture Theatre at Trinity College Dublin and delivered his 3-part lecture, What is Life? Later published as a book, his ideas were widely credited with inspiring molecular biology revolution. At the time, the molecular basis of life was unknown. Within 10 years, the structure of DNA had been discovered, the genetic code was cracked 8 years after that. Schrödinger moved to Dublin in 1939 after fleeing Nazi Germany and Austria. He was 53 and had already done the work that made him famous, including his eponymous wave equation and his infamous cap. He won a share of the 33 Physics Nobel Prize for his work in quantum mechanics, but as an outspoken critic of the Nazis, he was dismissed from his position at the University of Graz in Austria. He fled to Italy, the UK, and then to Belgium. You want to watch going to Belgium, mate? In 1940, he received a speculative offer from the Irish Tower Research Amon Del Valera, a former mathematician, to become the director of the planned Dublin Institute for Advanced Studies. Luckily for Del Valera, Schrödinger was an admirer of the Irish physicist William Hamilton. Hamiltonian, I like that. I'll have to work out more about Hamilton. His reformulation of Newtonian mechanics inspired his own work. That's his basic matrix formation. I've got to work it out. The action, Lagrangian, I'll have to really work this all out. He was glad to escape to neutral Ireland, and there he stayed until 1956. There with his 2 wives. He's a pretty amazing man. As the director of the Institute, it was George's duty to deliver annual public lectures. Like many a Nobel Prize winner, he used his academic freedom to think outside the subject. In What is Life, he used his knowledge of physics and atomic theory to speculate that life would turn out to be based on some sort of aperiodic crystal. He floated the idea of genetic code. Well, there you go. Look at that. Genetics. You have to really thank Schrödinger for it. James Watson and Francis Crick famously sent their 53 Nature paper on the structure of DNA to Schrödinger saying, we thought you might be interested in the enclosed reprints. You see, that it looks as though your term aperiodic crystal is going to be a very apt one. Isn't that beautiful? And the other thing is that there's another group besides Watson and Crick, which I've got to, James Watson and Francis Crick. There's another group out there, and what are they doing? I wish we knew they had a slightly different idea. Watson made a rare public appearance at the meeting, having seemingly put recent controversies about racist remarks behind him. He declined to speak to any journalists. Well, that's a go. Crick stood famous. What is Watson doing? But it just wasn't the scientists and journalists in attendance. The celebration was open to the general public. Given how productive the life sciences are right now, with the daily advances in neuroscience, genetics and immunology, bioengineering, gerontology and related disciplines, this added up to a mouth-watering prospect. Dublin's 1,200-seater National Concert Hall was packed full for the duration of the conference. As a feast of scientific information, the evident success brilliantly serving up excellent crash course in modern life science. But as an exercise in futurology, it was less satisfying. Most of the speakers dwelt firmly in the present, or replayed their greatest Nobel Prize-winning hits. Oh dear. That was Always likely. 25 years ago, Dublin hosted a similar conference to mark the 50th anniversary of What is Life. It attempted to recapture Strodinger's spirits of speculation, but, according to Mike Murphy, the University of Cambridge, who organised both conferences, it failed. One of our goals for the 2018 conference was to encourage the speakers to look to the future and take risks in speculating the future challenges and predictions, he said. Sadly, the conference on 5th to 6th December didn't quite manage it. But who can blame scientists for declining to speculate? Back in the 1933 meeting, nobody could have predicted some of the recurring highlights of the meeting. Gene editing, optogenetics, this is where you can actually stimulate a gene with a light. Cancer immunotherapy, ancient DNA sequencing, memory research, and theories of consciousness. In fact, even Schrodinger himself was reluctant to be a crystal ball. But it's aperiodic crystal. Admitting in the preface of his book that his speculations were based on second-hand, incomplete knowledge and that he was risking making a fool of himself. I hope I'm still around in 25 years to attend the 100th and refill my brain with science no one dared predict this time. That is pretty amazing. It is amazing. Science has absolutely blown my socks off. Okay. This is a really, I like this. I've just researched how MRA technology can actually see grey matter. That's a bit, I'll have to go back and reread. MRA is such a big thing. So there's a scan of someone's head here and they've colourised it with false colour. But it's a beautiful picture. You can see all the grey matter of the brain. It's sort of a beautiful thing to watch. It's a picture. So it's brain. It's emotion code cracked. What? Andy Coghlan. Patterns in the electrical brain activities may have been used to tell when people are sad, happy or depressed. The advance could lead to new ways of treating those with depression or anxiety using devices that constantly monitor their mood via brain signals. I just want to shoot myself if they do this one. Ultimately, the aim is to program the devices so they activate mood-uplifting brain networks when they detect potentially dangerous negative emotions. Oh, God. Can you imagine these going on a Kentucky tour with people with brain implants like that? By activating electrodes implanted in specific regions of people's brains, a process called deep brain stimulation, DBS, is already possible to ease conditions including depression, bipolar disorder, Tourette's syndrome, and obsessive compulsive disorder. Yeah, I just think that people tend to swear a lot. I think they've got, Australia's got Tourette's, we swear so much. There's also been advance towards mind reading, deducing memories and internal thoughts by monitoring the brain's electrical activity. Now it's possible to decipher the mood too. Quote, we've discovered how mood variations are decoded from the neuro signals in the human brain, quote, oh, thank goodness. Oh, the human brain, oh, yes. And it says Miriam Sanchi of the University of Southern California, who is the lead researcher on the project, quote, it's a significant step towards creating new therapies that use brain stimulation to treat debilitating mood and anxiety disorders. Sanchi and her colleagues recruited 7 people with epilepsy who each had been temporarily fitted with implanted with electrodes to identify major sources of their seizures. By monitoring the electrical outputs of the electrodes, the teams honed in the fingerprint patterns of activity across the brain that closely correspond to each of the specific moods each person must experience. To make it possible, each participant was periodically filled out a questionnaire on their mood. From each answer, they rated how they felt on a 7-point scale. Quote, we're able to uncover the patterns of brain signals that matched itself to reported moods. So you say, these things are so, flaky. When we use the knowledge to build a decoder that would independently recognize the patterns of signals corresponding to certain modes, the decoder successfully detected the mood of 7 people 75% of the time. Well, again, statistically, it's pretty amazing. The patterns were different for each study participant, but most of all patterns were confined to the limbic system, a network of brain regions called crucial for triggering emotional moods. Sanchez stressed that decoding is only the first step. For a device to be able to treat people as well as monitor mood, for example, the team needed to establish which part of the brain must be stimulated to head off impending depression or anxiety. The safety and inconvenience of implanting electrodes is also a major hurdle, but non-invasive systems are being developed that use electrodes on the heads to stimulate brain regions. Mood is very hard to measure, says Thomas Schaufer, who uses DBS to treat depression at the University Hospital of Freiburg in Germany. Quote, "The fact that they find mood correlates with predictive electrical signals is a stunning and lovely concept." What animal were they giving ecstasy to? I can't remember. I hate my memory going. Heard a news article, someone was giving ecstasy to something. I really can't remember. This is interesting. Glass box of atomic vapor is a tiny radio. Oh no, this sounds, so it could be really upset. By Leah Crane. Let's see what they say. Radios are shrinking. An atomic receiver has been developed in a tiny glass box that has the ability to handle a wide range of frequencies, would make it excellent for spying. David Anderson of Rydberg Technology in Michigan and his colleagues built their radio receiver to be smaller and more secure than traditional radios. At its heart is a centimeter-sized glass box full of cesium vapor. Well, you have to heat it up. Cesium atoms are prepared so that some of the electrons have more energy than normal, i.e. they're metastable, which makes them highly sensitive to certain frequencies of electromagnetic waves. Okay, they've got a transition level to there. Radio transmissions work by modulating electromagnetic wave to encode sounds you want to transmit. The waves are generally received by antenna, which converts them to electricity. Then speaker circuits turn those electrical signals back into sounds. The new radio receiver, the cesium atoms, looks like an antenna. Well, that's really depressing. Because the dipole transition moment is an antenna function. It goes the same thing. So you can use your mobile phone. It's the same equation as an atom. Temporary bumps some of the electrons up to a higher level, changing the atom's quantum state. Wow. There's nothing else, does it? It turns out to sound, the team shines the laser through the box. Atoms in different states absorb laser light differently. So measuring the light that passes through these levels reveals its quantum state. They in turn can be translated back into the original signal. Unlike traditional radio receivers, this compact design works at multiple frequency bands, well beyond what was a car radio can pick up, says Anderson. This could be useful for espionage if you think about scanning spy radio trickers trying to pick up someone talking to you. You can scan all kinds of secure channels that are in the area, says Anderson. Instead of requiring multiple types of antenna of a receiving station, you can use one small vapor receiver to do all of it. What can I say? Why would it be broadband? I just can't imagine. Okay, this is good. Interview, news and technology, perhaps page for Leah Crane again. The woman who heard stars spin. In 1974, the discovery of pulsars and the Nobel Prize, but it didn't go to the woman who found them in 67. Instead, her supervisor took the glory. Now, Jocelyn Bell Burnell, pictured, who first detected the fast-rotating neutron stars sweep a beam of radio waves or other radiation across the sky, has been awarded $3 million Special Breakthrough Prize in Fundamental Physics. Thank goodness. Question. How did you discover the pulsar? When I came to Cambridge, I found myself suffering from what I now know as imposter syndrome. But I was a bit of a survivor and decided that until they threw me out, I was going to work my very hardest. So I was being extremely thorough and spotted the anomalous signal. I tracked the big this spot of the sky for several months with the telescopes tracking and picking up pulses. We established that the object had to be small because the pulses were short and sharp, but it had to be big because the pulses were always at the same rate. They weren't getting tired or slowing down. We eventually found that they were small in width and big in mass, but it took some time to get our heads around that. This next question. What questions about the universe can we answer with pulsars? There are pairs of pulses orbiting each other in a close binary system that is proving important to checking Einstein's theory of gravity. People are a bit worried that we don't understand gravity, but so far these pulses are showing Einstein's right. Why did you leave astronomy research? I got engaged to be married. Between discovering pulses 2 and 3, I wore my engagement ring into the lab, which was a mistake. That time in Britain, married women didn't work. It was really quite a lot, tough time. I moved away from radio astronomy. Oh, bloody hell. Where do you go next? The phase following my PhD was extremely miscellaneous. I was married to a man who had to move jobs regularly, so we were moving up and down the country. I had the opportunity to try different roles outside the research career. I had acquired a whole raft of skills, which is why I've been asked to be president of various bodies like the Institute of Physics. I was also in part of a group of women who established the Athena Swan Initiative. Okay, now what's her name? Henrietta Leavitt, sorry. Okay. I started quite a long time ago with a small group of senior women meeting after work, wondering if we could do to improve the position of women in science. We decided to create a prize for the university of the best women so they competed for it, and they did. Do you have any plans for this $3 million prize money? I've been talking to the Institute of Physics, which I'm glad to say is very happy to go along with this idea I have. It's that the money goes to graduate studentships for physics for people who are from underrepresented groups. I've come up with this because of my feeling that a lot of the thrust behind my discovery of pulses was because I was an outsider. If we can support more people from the underrepresented groups, we can move to these interesting ideas. Poor thing. So my Michael Lepage. Solar wind farms may bring rain to Sahara, or if it does, we've got plenty of deserts in Australia which can do this as well. Covering the Sahara Desert with solar panels and wind farms wouldn't only help power the world, it would also improve the local climate. Rainfall there would be more than double, and there would be a modest increase in vegetation cover. So I don't know if you know about the deserts. Doubling the rainfall of the desert is just sort of like nothing, because there's no water there ever. There'll be a slight greening of the Sahara, said Fred Kerchowski, an Abbasam International Center of Theoretical Physics in Italy. This wouldn't be enough to return the Sahara to the much greener state just 6,000 years ago, but the overall impact would be beneficial, and the greening effect would be amplified by other methods such as tree planting. Its plentiful sun and wind, sparse population, closeness to Europe make the Sahara Desert prime real estate for the solar and wind farms. If I can say, it's far more urgent that we get, so this is North Africa powering the energy needs of Europe. We should power the energy needs of Indonesia, because it's just criminal what they have to do to them up there. Okay. Morocco is already building large solar plants, but any changes made to land surfaces, from cutting down forests to covering deserts in solar panels, affects climate. According to the climate model used by the team at Kershi, covering the entire desert in either solar or wind farms would lead to more air rising above the Sahara and thus more rainfall there. But building both would have an even greater effect. Covering them all. Okay. This would happen because insulating dark solar patterns would change the brightness of the ground surface, and turbines would alter the drag of air resistance at the surface. As rainfall increases, more vegetation grows. This boosts evaporation and warms the surface, leaving more air rising up in the Sahara. Covering only part of the Sahara would have a smaller effect. Oh, wow. Stretch-tracking. The team's model suggests that covering the other desert with solar and wind farms would have little effect, perhaps because they're smaller than the Sahara. Yeah, unfortunately that has not inspired me. That's interesting to see that earthquake produced. Image made by a million artists illustrates cultural evolution. This community generated digital works shed lights on how cultural phenomena evolve. Called Place, it's a commemorative art project launched by the website Reader on April 1st, 2017. The users could edit any of 1,000 by 1,000 squares, choosing from 16 colours. Then they had to wait about 5 to 20 minutes before they could place another pixel. In the 72 hours that followed, over a million people battled for control of the canvas, painting mascots, logos, Pokemon images, patterns, memes, affiliations, and other national flags. Thomas Muller and James Winter of the Max Planck Institute of Science and Human History saw this as an opportunity to study cultural evolution, as you would, in which theory suggests that ideas and behaviours are shared when they start to adopt more predictable patterns. Oh, God. Muller and Winter used the theory to predict after initial increase in complexity, place should simplify, and the data bore this out. And with the file size of place, a maker of complexity, peaking at around 30-hour mark and decreasing thereafter. Early artists could spread out, making place chaotic. But the canvas filled, the structure emerged, the artwork's survival depended on maintaining the borders of that structure, which required evolution of rules among the users, mirroring how cultural phenomena like languages entertain. I suppose that's an analogy. Expect more tsunamis in a warmer world. One of the highest tsunamis on record was probably caused by global warming, and a warmer world will mean more of the same. A landslide near the end of the Tyndall Glacier in Alaska sent 180 million tons of rocks into the Challenger Fjord on the 17th of October 2015. On the other side of the valley, the resulting wave climbed 193 metres. According to a new study, one of the highest tsunamis on record. Researchers say landslide was caused by the glacier's retreat, probably as a result of global warming. They warn the risk of such events will rise as the Earth heats up. Maybe. When glaciers leave the ocean would be a major problem. Glaciers carve out a steep-sided valleys, and they're usually a ford or lake where they end. Globally, glaciers are retreating, leaving unstable slopes. Thawing exposed mountainsides can destabilize them further. Fortunately, the areas at risk are remote with few residents, and tsunamis weaken rapidly with distance, unlike those caused by undersea quakes. However, there is still potential for disaster, co-author Brentwood Hickman, a non-profit organisation called Ground Truth Trekking Points to Glacier Bay in Alaska, and an at-risk area that thousands of people at a time visit in cruise ships. Right. I think you've got certain articles of you can get going up with a disaster. Ancient Mega Mill fed Roman sailors. In 1937, a Roman complex with 16 water wheels was discovered in Bar-Bengal in southern France, the largest ancient water-powered factory found in the world. But rather than producing flour for the nearby Roman city of are late. As previously assumed, it seems to be centralized for ships of biscuits. During the digs in 37, limescale deposits from the mill wheels were found. Isotropic analysis by Chiz Poitier of Johannes Gutenberg University in Germany, which has to be done now, not 1937, his team has now shown that the limescale wasn't deposited year-round, and suggests the mills shut in late summer and autumn. A city would need a year-round to supply flour. Instead, the team think the mill's flour were destined for ships, biscuits, and Roman vessels in the Mediterranean. These would have been no demand for winter when the fleet laid up to avoid storms. Jupiter's iconic red spot has a blue rival. Okay. Jupiter's famous red spot. It's famous for red spot, and now for its blue spot too. The blue spot was discovered by a team Kimberly Moore at Harvard University. Analyzed the data on magnetic field lines within Jupiter collected by NASA's Juno probe. Unlike the Earth's highly uniform field with the poles at opposite ends of the planet, Jupiter's field is irregular and asymmetric. Well, that's interesting. The magnetic field generated inside the planet follows inside the planet. Flows into space via a zone in the northern hemisphere and re-enters converging on the blue spot just below Jupiter's equator. Okay, here we go. The spot isn't actually blue. Right, thanks for that, New Scientist. But it appears so because of the colour scale used to map the magnetic field. So, yeah, gee, that's almost offensive. That's almost like clickbaiting. Robert uses its ears to see like a bat, i.e. uses echolocation, I suppose. Bats use the sound to navigate the surrounding in the dark. Now Robert's called Robat. Can do the same. The four-wheeled autonomous robot pictured below is equipped with a speaker to move a bat's mouth and two microphones positioned to the left and right to move ears. As it moves, robot speakers produce high-frequency chirps every half metre. It can then identify the distance to obstacles by calculating the delay between the sounds of the echo. Any difference in the two microphones pick up gives the robot your general ultrasonic senses. I don't quite understand the new Lego kits, but let's go. This is known as echolocation. The same techniques used by bats in the dark. Well, bats in general doesn't have to use that. Put robot to the test. Yossi Yoffel of Tel Aviv University in Italy, in Israel, and its colleagues placed it in a greenhouse of a botanical garden. Robot was able to drive the plant line paths, avoiding obstacles such as a bucket and a chair, while drawing a map of the surroundings. Bats probably can also identify specific objects using echolocation, so Yule and his team gave Robat an algorithm to classify if something was a plant or not. A robot like this could be useful in situations of limited visibility, such as extreme weather or searching rubble for a survivor after a disaster. Oh, Godfather. Okay, keep on pushing myself here. I've just got to push myself a little bit more each lesson, each time we go through. Taking probiotics may be useless or might cause harm. Probiotics, living microorganisms, are used by millions of people to boost their guts, biomes, or restore it after taking antibiotics. May not work and could even do them harm. Well, let's see if I can get this piece of information out of my head. The findings come from two studies of Aaron El Naviv and Weizmann Institute of Science in Israel. In the first, his team sampled the microbiome of healthy people. Then, the 15 volunteers took either a placebo or a probiotic supplement. Probiotic organisms colonized the gut of some, but in others, they were expelled. Next, the team measured what happens to the people who take probiotics after antibiotic use. A group of 21 people took identical courses of antibiotics, then split into three groups of probably seven. Gee, getting really low. Seven people. Where's this? sounds like an what team, what universe is that? We're not told. Okay, this is weird as. The first letter covered by itself, while the second took probiotics. The third received a dose of the original biomes through fecal motor transfer. They had the poo reintroduced. Probacteria colonized the gut of everyone in this second group after antibiotics had cleared the way. However, this prevented the return of a person's normal microbiomes for up to 6 months, longer than those that are allowed to recover naturally. For people given the dose of their own poo, a native gut was restored in days. While the clinical impact of the lengthy biome disturbances was not measured, earlier studies have found the link between gut microbe destruction and ill health. So that's just really poor science. Okay. Sharks like some veg with its meat. The bonnethead shark is first known omnivorous shark, getting some of its nutrients from seagrass. So that's like Bruce from Finding Nemo. Where's Australian shark? Fish are friends, not meals. Biologists had previously noticed that bonnetheads, a relative of the hammerhead, eat lots of seagrass as well as crustaceans and all shellfish. That's because, but because the shark's digestive system looks almost identical to those of other meat-eating sharks, it seems best suited for high-protein diets. It was assumed that the seagrass ingestion was accidental. To test this, Samantha Lee of the University of California, IP and her friends, fed 5 wild-caught bonnetheads a diet of 90% seagrass and 10% squid for 3 weeks before dissecting their digestive tracts. Oh, that should be rather... Oh, yes. Yum, yum, yum. Are you really happy, happy, happy? And now we're going to dissect you. They found enzymes for carbohydrate digestion were active in the as those in fish with an omnivorous and herbivorous diet. Analyzing blood and liver tissue showed them that the sharks take up seagrass nutrients, absorbing more than 50% of its organic matter, carbohydrates, proteins, and vitamins, making them relatively efficient plant eaters. Butcher birds use whiplash to kill. Shrikes, dubbed butcher birds because they impale the head to prey on thorns, also known for killing animals much heavier than themselves. Now we know how to do it. Oh, there's a little mouse being... Oh, gee, that's not too sweet. There's a little mouse stabbing on a thorn. High-speed camera footage of the captive shrikes show that they use their beaks to finally grip their prey in the napped neck before flinging them around with such force that they sustained fatal lash injuries. Douglas Sunter of California State University in San Marcos and his colleagues filmed loggerhead shrikes killing mice. What great fun. Let's go and film a few shrikes. Give them a few bits of mice. Shrikes are being trained for... Oh, well, yeah, that's what they've done. Shrikes are being trained for release into the wild on California's San Clemente Island. So no mice were fed, so the birds... Let me see. So no mice were fed to the birds solely for research. So I don't quite understand that statement. The shrikes are being trained for release into the wild on California, St. Clement Island. So no mice were fed to the birds solely for research. Oh, so we would, that's why we, the mice were nice mice and they had to die anyway. The team found mice were flung around with force 6 times gravity, 6G, and the emotions of their head and body progressively came, shifted out of phase. Oh dear, okay, it's the oscillation, 6G, in such a way, out of phase. They died through inertial forces of the neck created in their own body spinning around. This is sustainia explains how many species of sharks are able to kill prey up to twice their own body weight, such as lizards and snakes. Thank you.
podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.